compartmentalize in a live setting. That depending on the shape of the venue and the stage, depending on the setup, I might only be able to hear myself. And that was the case. I couldn't hear the vocals or kick drum or bass. We were 5 people playing a solo show simultaneously and not on purpose, not as a graduate school thesis or as an art project. When people gripe about girls' rock camps or schools of rock, saying music, especially popular forms, can't be institutionalized or taught, maybe part of that is true. But I always think about that night. How if the process had been demystified, less of a private club or a secret code, we wouldn't have sat in the dark theater after we played, watching coding deliver a taut, deliberate set, while we felt undeserving of having ever been on stage, blaming one another and ourselves, mad and heartbroken. Part 2. Slater Kinney. Chapter 6. Schooled. I finally made my move to Olympia, nominally to return to school, in the summer of 1993. I was 18 years old. Through writing to Toby Vail, Becca Albee, and other girls I'd met via fanzines and Riot Girl, I managed to set up a sublet at a place called The Haunted House, aka The Punk House, aka The Blue House. All the shared houses had names like that, often descriptors of their aesthetic, their proximity to a landmark or store, or referring to some talisman contained therein. Most residents knew little of the origin of their house's moniker. I was going to live in the room of Justin Troster, who was heading out on tour with his band Unwound. When I moved to Olympia, I didn't really think of myself as a musician. I don't know if I would consider myself a musician now, not in the technical sense. I don't know much theory. I play by instinct and feel. I could probably get schooled by an 8-year-old on tonics and inversions. But back then, the word musician had a professional characteristic to it that would have made it even more alienating and anathema. Back then, I was still just a fan of music. And to be a fan of music also meant to be a fan of cities, of places. Regionalism, and the creative scenes therein, played an important role in the identification and contextualization of a sound or aesthetic. Music felt married to place, and the notion of somewhere predated the internet-seeming invention of everywhere, which often ends up feeling like nowhere. Technically, in order to save face with my father, I moved to Olympia to attend Evergreen. But Olympia itself was a university I wanted to attend. Everything coming out of that scene had started to define me, or at least I wanted it to. The labels K Records and Kill Rock Stars, the bands, the fanzines, the people, the remnants of Riot Girl, the clothes. It was a world I was desperate to be part of. I wanted a new family of outlaws, of queers and provocative punks, of wit and sexiness. I had one trajectory, and that was to get out of Redmond, of my childhood, of my head. But I needed a place to land. I needed a place to take me in. It was both a calculated move and an aimless one. I possessed the force of a bullet, albeit one shot from a very shoddy gun. I showed up to Olympia a wanderer. I had about 2 months until school started. I spent the first few weeks walking around downtown, stopping in at the State Theater or thrift stores or the Martin Apartments, places I knew people I wanted to be friends with worked or hung out. I lingered and muttered. I waited around. I was desperate to insert myself into situations, to learn, to observe. I was an archaeologist of sorts, but I wanted to be a participant, to be connected and engaged. I was shy, which didn't help. Underneath that nervousness, however, I had a cunningness and intentionality, or at least a cluelessness that was intrepid enough to get the job done. I cared too much about what people thought, but also not enough. I didn't mind that I was just hanging around. I didn't want to be discovered. I wanted to be part of the discovery. I knew who all the players were, as if I were joining a sorority. I wanted to meet everyone. These musicians and punk bands, whom I'd read about in fanzines or seen mentioned in a record label newsletter, in Maximum Rock and Roll or Punk Planet, were idols to me, larger than life. All my early school years vying for attention and status, a game I'd given up years before, I rechanneled and traded in for a different currency, a punk and indie rock currency, a marketplace of art and ideas. Here we dealt in arcane musical knowledge, in being completists, archivists, contrarians. We would go out on tours and come back with evidence from other scenes. It felt like reconnaissance in that way, like we were explorers and spies, an army. I was scared my first summer in Olympia, flailing but strangely bold. I biked around town and rode skateboards in the Capitol parking lot. I drank too much malt liquor and cried on basement floors while bands played. I had unrequited crushes on girls, on entire bands, but mostly dated boys. More often than not, I woke up hungover in friends' beds after a night of platonic spooning. I didn't care about setting down roots or having anything consistent. I wanted to be everywhere, talk to everyone. I was fumbling and barely formed, insecure and baby-faced, in polyester high waters from the thrift store, and used men's shoes with crummy soles and stretched, worn insides that my feet slid around in. I wore too tight t-shirts and chunky belts, cut my own bangs uneven and jagged like an upside-down skyline, laughed too hard at everything, overshared. A band called Huggy Bear from England descended upon our little town that summer. Afraid to fly, their guitarist, John Slade, stayed home, so Billy from Bikini Kill was the replacement. Huggy Bear were energetic, with a sophistication that not many of us in the Northwest had pulled off. They were cheeky. I don't know if that word has ever been ascribed to someone not from the United Kingdom. They conveyed drollness in their music. It was coy, sexy, and serpentine. I saw every show they played in the region, following them up to Seattle, driving down to Portland. I was a puppy dog for punk, and for Joe, who was probably the first girl I both really wanted, and wanted to be. Sunglasses wearing, aloof, mysterious, with catchy riffs, her treble boosted so that it hissed through the songs. I drank so I'd have the nerve to keep hanging out, well past when I should have gone home. I tagged along on a trip to the ocean. I felt like a drifter. My heart hurt, and I hated it. Most nights I spent at basement punk shows, where we'd drink beer out of paper bags and sway like grass. I saw Carp and Unwound, Mary Lou Lord, Elliot Smith, Rancid, Jawbreaker, Drive Like Jehu. It seemed like a touring band came through Olympia every night. Bands that would never play small towns now stopped there to hang out and fraternize with their friends in the local scene. They dropped into home recording studios to make a 7-inch. They partied, they crashed on floors and hooked up with their Oli girlfriends. Sometimes they'd play multiple nights. Bigger bands like Beck or Stereolab would play the backstage of the Capitol Theater. The stage set up so performers would have their backs to the seats and the balcony while the audience stood in what is usually everything behind the curtain. It sounded horrible as most of the noise escaped up into the main room. But I didn't think much at all about fidelity or professionalism, just about experience, about witnessing, about watching the way someone else danced or moved. All the music was still very much a mystery, how it all cohered. I discerned very little between good and bad bands, popular or obscure. Every band was good. Every player had a purpose, was standing his or her ground, contributing, making a sound. Any band was worth buying a single from, supporting, dancing along to. I could find appeal in the sway of a bass player or the cocky head bop of a drummer, in the musculature, in the posturing, in the daring hint of sexiness that you'd never witness off stage, in a glance or glare, in the reveal of a fang, in a singer's spit in the act of screaming, in sweat forming on a chest or hairlines, in a dropped pick somehow reclaimed mid-song, in a smile between two band members. I saw merit and beauty in it all, and if not beauty, then purpose, or at least just a way of positing yourself in the world, standing in one spot and being heard, etching your name somewhere, even if it disappeared shortly after. But at the time it all felt permanent, the most permanent and concrete thing I'd ever felt, and I was surrounded. Mostly what I felt was that I wanted to do that too. But there was also, of course, the actual college. Olympia's communal spirit possessed an almost utilitarian mindset, where our worth was measured by the happiness and progress of the whole. Not coincidentally, almost all of us in the music scene had gone to the Evergreen State College. Founded in the late 1960s, Evergreen favors experiential learning. Grades are qualitative, and it is unnecessary to declare a major. At the core of Evergreen pedagogy is the seminar, wherein students and their professors engage in polemical discussion. The seminar doesn't adhere to the more hierarchical lecture format. Instead, it allows for a collective sharing, examination, and deconstruction of ideas. I often suspected the Olympia music scene would not have existed outside of this influence. Though it mimicked other punk scenes in its anti-corporate stance, it was a community in dialogue with itself. The rhetoric surrounding and about the scene was tantamount in importance to the labels, the bands, the musicians. We operated as if in a constant seminar. Everything was mutable and vulnerable to critique. It was all a shared experience. Bands felt like collective entities, with everyone having a say in what the music meant, calling out each other on wrong steps, an exhausting endeavor, but one that built a special and sometimes frustrating insularity. Olympia was the quintessential in-crowd versus out-crowd. Visiting bands were either in awe or felt thoroughly snubbed. Though there was indeed a certain amount of snobbery, I think it was that our interactions had been codified, partly as an identifier, but also by necessity. The claustrophobia of small-town dynamics makes for new rules in terms of greetings and salutations. Privacy and alone time were often only achieved by looking down as you walked along the streets. This mode of self-preservation and insularity can be off-putting to visitors. Playing music seemed like the easiest way to communicate with my friends in Olympia. Everyone, it seemed, was not in one band, but in two or three. It would have been easier to count the people not in bands. And the music's value wasn't always based on technical acuity. There was a lot of deliberate underachieving and subversion. Bands like Witchy Poo wore helmets and had transient members. They did spoken word over barely tuned guitars. The premium was not always on singing, but on earnestness. Sincerity croaked out or yelped. Love songs made tart and less trite because they were voiced in a slant slope or scream. Angst compensated for everything. Sun Velvet Sidewalk, Kicking Giant, Carp, duos and trios that sang as if every line was punctuated with an exclamation point. It was the sound of a magnified muttering, loud and distorted. Some bands possessed a purposeful clumsiness, while others couldn't help teetering, but any inelegance masked something sharper. Scissors and knives. I started playing with Becca Albee and CJ Phillips. We called our band Excuse 17. Becca was a writer and artist from Portland, Maine, who was going to school at Evergreen. She lived in the Martin Apartments, which were the veritable Melrose Place of Olympia, a punk rock dormitory right in the center of town. Becca had been kind to me from the beginning. She seemed eager to forge a musical project with someone new in town, someone not already associated with another band. We both played guitar, and in typical Ollie style, a bass player seemed an unnecessary addition. Becca had a good sense of melody and of creating character and story in songs, which there wasn't a lot of in the first-person, sometimes stark narratives of the Riot Grrrl bands. She listened to Elvis Costello and Throwing Muses and had a slightly more sophisticated palette than I did. I was always seeking a kindred desperation in music, whereas Becca possessed a sturdiness that allowed her to appreciate the more refined. I was anxious to pour my guts out, and many of my songs with Excuse 17 are a sonic and lyrical purging. A caged animal who upon release heads straight to the recording studio. Fortunately, Becca's intelligence tempered my screeches and squawks, and I managed to learn about co-writing, about arrangement, and about restraint. Then there was CJ, who was from the Seattle suburb of Federal Way. He had an affect of sensitivity that was so common among the young men I knew as to be pro forma, this gentleness of phase many men entered or adopted as they tried to navigate the matrifocal environs of Olympia. Compared with our counterparts, I think Excuse 17 felt relatively normal and non-threatening. We were well-mannered, thoughtful, and square. At one point early on, Becca and I tried to stir up drama by saying we had made out on a weekend getaway, just to add a sense of salaciousness or myth. No one cared or believed us. Excuse 17 made two records, and we all saw the country for the first time together. We were treated a little like junior varsity players, not good enough to be on the real team, but by being around, we helped make the whole program seem legitimate. We went on tour opening for Heavens to Betsy, where Korn and I watched each other play every night and developed a mutual admiration. Before our show at the famed CBGB, a friend drove Korn and me to the Empire State Building, where we rode an elevator up to the observation deck, looked out over a luminous and pulsating city, then descended back into the grid, returning to the club only a few moments before we needed to play. We missed out on seeing our opening act, a singer whom we were told was too afraid to look at the audience. Nevertheless, CJ said her voice and songs were stunning, that they'd made him cry. He proudly showed us the 7-inch single he'd purchased, the first one released by this artist who went by the name Cat Power. If nothing else, those early tours with Becca and CJ allowed me to watch bands and musicians from other cities play over and over again, night after night. I would watch Richard Beluyet of Versus and Christina Bellotti of Slant Six play guitar. Richard really split apart and arpeggiated the chords, like a dour version of R.E.M.'s Peter Buck. Christina's guitar tone was grodgy, with distinction. Not just a growl, it had teeth. And the relationship between her singing and playing really influenced me. The way she sang her guitar lines, made them a unified theme, and then broke them apart. She had a great voice, cool and insouciant. I wasn't a good singer, but I had a decent grasp of melody, so I tried to approximate the notes. By the time Excuse 17 was ending, my guitar playing style was getting closer to what early Slater-Kinney would sound like and what I ended up bringing to the table with Corin. Since neither Excuse 17 nor Slater-Kinney had a bass player, the trick was finding a way of filling out the sound, making sure it had a depth and low end. We weren't into a lo-fi trebly noise. We weren't interested in accentuating or exaggerating the fact that we didn't have a traditional bass player. We wanted to sound like a full rock band. I suppose it's strange that our solution wasn't to simply add a bass player, but we didn't. Living in Olympia, we had lost perspective on what a traditional group looked or sounded like. Band configurations were abnormal, either multi-limbed or conspicuously amputated. Additionally, neither Corin nor I were interested in playing too many bar or power chords, so my chords were half-formed. I was always trying to leave room for Corin. My entire style of playing was built around somebody else playing guitar with me, a story that on its own sounds unfinished, a sonic to be continued, designed to be completed by someone else. Corin had been the sole songwriter in Heavens to Betsy, and the only other instrument in her band was drums. She had never played with another guitarist before, but she and Tracy had not approached the combination of guitar and drums from a conventional standpoint either, largely due to lack of experience and skill, and it made for a distinct sound. Neither settled nor locked into each other. They were like two soloists, the drums an insistent knock on the door, while Corin played by herself in another room. By the time we were in Slater-Kinney together, we had both, and perhaps unintentionally, developed ways of playing that were very compatible with each other, each having made minute adjustments in our other bands, each used to compensating yet unafraid of space or discord. I think part of the uniqueness of our sound is that we rarely land on a basic chord. The music stays somewhere in between. It's always not quite right, which of course can sound more right than anything, or at least like nothing else. In Heavens to Betsy, Corin had always tuned her guitar to her own voice, so it was completely arbitrary that when she plugged into a tuner one day in an attempt to coordinate our tuning, her guitar happened to be in C sharp. We never thought to alter it. It's 1.5 steps below standard tuning, which creates a sourness, a darkness that you have to overcome if you're going to create something at all harmonious and palatable. So even when we're getting toward a little bit of catchiness or pop sheen, there's an underlying bitterness to it. The tuning also forced Corin to sing differently. It pushed her into her higher registers, into a wailing, the outer edges. Corin was small with large eyes and an intense stare, like she was in a state of both pre-grudging and pre-judging. In reality, she was neither. She was kind, thoughtful, and fiercely loyal, though you would not want to cross her. She lived on the top floor of a duplex in the South Capitol neighborhood in Olympia. It was a studio apartment with sloped ceilings, the kitchen the size of a closet. Using a label maker, she had printed out words and phrases and stuck them on various household objects. It was part feminist art show, part lecture hall, part house of mirrors. You'd walk around the apartment and be confronted with words like racist affixed to a can of Calumet baking powder. I'm not sure why she didn't just avoid the brand, but I suppose if you're in a period of continual confrontation, why stop it yourself? Then you'd see the cheap full-length mirror leaning against the wall, plastic frame broken and bent, and the words, "You are beautiful," on a sticker across the top. Even when in the name of self-affirmations, the label maker made the words ominous and jarring. I always felt like I was bumping into walls in that apartment, the way those words would jump out at me like boogeymen when all I wanted to do was cook or check out my hair in the reflection. But I played along, learned from the process. I was under the tutelage of this strange world where you lived and examined all at once, questioned everything. It was school. One day I got to my house, and Corin had left me a message on the answering machine saying that we should name the band Slater-Kinney. I knew Slater-Kinney as the name of the road near which we had a practice space, a building not in Olympia, but in the adjacent town of Lacey, which blistered with rundown chain stores and shoddy annual carnivals. At the time, I don't think we planned on doing much with this band. There was very little deliberation, no long list of potential names or backup ideas. Sleater-Kinney is a strange name. It sounds like a law firm, or, as Laurie Moore pointed out in one of her books, a hospital. We're none of those things, nor are we relatives of the Slaters or Kinneys. But in the end, the moniker could be whatever we wanted it to be. It could embody whatever and whoever we were. Part in awe of the possibilities of this collaboration and my enthusiasm toward it, part unsure how seriously I should be taking all of this, I tried to draw out the silliness in Corin. If we were going to really do this band, then I wanted to be myself around her, and myself was perhaps more goofy than I'd let on. I wanted to balance the seriousness with levity. I tell her made-up fairy-tale-like stories in order to entertain her, buy her trophies at thrift stores, or we'd sit around and listen to the operatic cheese of classic rock records like Supertramp or Boston, the latter of whose song, More Than a Feeling, we'd cover in our first recording sessions. We'd make out on her bed, no frame, just a mattress and box spring on the floor. We kept things waist up, her suggestion, as she still had a boyfriend with whom she had an agreement that she could kiss members of the same sex. At 19, you can make out for hours, that goalless, amorphous melting into someone else. Finally, Corin broke up with her boyfriend. He acknowledged my so-called victory by giving me a photo he'd found of a boy sitting inside a basketball hoop. The note on the back read, "You bagged my girl, Dan." When I say that my experience with the music scene replaced traditional college experiences, that includes the sloppy, makeshift romantic aspects as well. There seemed to be a spin-the-bottle party about once a month. My first year in Olympia, I sat in the hallway of the Martin Apartments while kissing happened in rooms I was too afraid to enter. Eventually, I joined in. It felt like everyone was queer, that our sexuality and desires had less to do with our physical selves and more to do with music and art. Lust was part of the creative process, but the desire was often ambient. We did pair off into couples and dated, but there was a fluidity to all things corporeal and quotidian. Perhaps because so many of us toured or played music, the hours were not structured around traditional industry or business, around mornings or lunch breaks. In those days, I hung out all the time, traveled in groups to group houses to eat group meals. We were amoebic. I was impressionable, open. One year, K Records had a Valentine's Day party in the giant warehouse where they were headquartered. In the big room, there was dancing. Across the hall, my friends Chad Quirolo, booking agent, and Julie Butterfield, public relations, were sharing an office, and they turned the smaller room into an exclusive, more intimate gathering. A spin-the-bottle game coalesced in the middle of the room, but soon spread out from the circle. Playing oldies from an AM radio station, we swayed and kissed. Mouths met in every corner, gooey and wet. Gay boys kissed their best female friends. Bandmates broke hard and fast rules. People in relationships put their promises on hold. It was sensual and disastrous. The next day I went over to Calvin Johnson's house, head pounding, stomach stormy. I wanted to see my friend Miranda July before she went back home to Portland. Her neck was covered in hickeys. "Who are those from?" I asked. "You," she answered. For days after, everyone walked around with a cold. I met Miranda in 1994. When Excuse 17 and Heavens to Betsy played at the punk rock venue known as 924 Gilman Street in Berkeley, California. Miranda was back in her hometown that summer, on break from UC Santa Cruz. After playing our show, we stayed the night at her best friend's parents' house. Miranda came over in the morning, her hair cropped short in the color of a ripe blueberry. She was scrawny and angular, pale, with bright, piercing eyes, both delicate and dangerous, a rabid bunny. Within a few minutes of chatting with her in the kitchen, Miranda figured out that I was lying about my age. I wanted to seem more mature, 20, when in actuality I was only 19. I think Miranda admired my gumption, and I admired her directness. We've been friends ever since. A few years later in Olympia, we were both dating older people who happened to have been a former couple. Miranda and I were living in crappy apartments, hers in Portland, the walls painted in garish circus stripes, mine in Olympia, carpeted and smelling as musty and stale as the thrift store from which all my furniture had come. Our respective dates lived in houses where they cooked and did laundry and had a second set of sheets. Miranda and I often wondered whether she and I shouldn't be together instead, but we never were. Instead, we forged a friendship based on shared ideas, adventures, mutual scrappiness, and curiosity. Miranda was already a polymath, recording spoken word records and making short films. She ran a video distribution company called Big Miss Moviola, later called Joni for Jackie. Girls from around the world would send her their short films. She would compile them and then release them like a visual chain letter. Slater Kinney played some shows with a group she was singing in called the C.B. Barnes Band. They had a variety of singers, and when it was Miranda's turn to be the front person, she seemed to emerge as if resurfacing from underwater, slithering and startled. Despite our loyalty to them, both Miranda and I felt slightly outside our own communities, but even early on there was a sense we'd be safe and emboldened as a team. Chapter 7. Self-titled. When I flew to Australia in the fall of 1994, I had never been overseas. It seems outlandish now that I'd pick one of the most far-flung places on the map and endeavor to start a band there, but at the time it felt like a reckless sense of possibility. Olympia is at the edge of a rainforest, and it's the grayest place I've ever lived. There's a dreariness to the town. It's a state capital, but it has a downtrodden feel. A combination of longshoremen, state workers, students. It feels like a transitional place. You always feel soaked. When I landed in Sydney at 6 a.m., after a 15-hour flight from L.A., the morning was already brightening. Corn wouldn't land for another 11 hours, but I was met by Stephen O'Neill from the Canaanes, a person we knew only from correspondence, our host, our drummer, and hopefully our friend. His mouth had an upward tilt on one side that gave him a look of sweet eagerness. He picked me up in a navy blue van, and everything was novel to me, including the fact that we were driving on the wrong side of the road, and it was spring. It looked like if San Diego were a country. Exotic, dense flora and fauna, a mix of desert, beautiful spots of green and color, bright terraced houses, tropical sounds. I felt that first awareness that there's a whole set of species whose sounds and calls you've never heard. The wonder of realizing that people are growing up with an entirely different sensory experience from yours. This whole country seemed so shiny to me. The night before we left home, it rained hard. Corinne had moved out of her apartment with no help from me. I was bidding farewell to a group of friends instead. And while attempting to open her door and wrangle a box, the door swung into her face and cut her above the eye. When Corin landed in Sydney, I'd had 30 hours of anticipation and excitement. We were going to start our band in this country, while she'd had 30 hours for a deep resentment to congeal and solidify. She was cold and distant and had a swollen bruise above her eye, lashed by a freshly scabbed over cut. Because it was too painful to put in her contacts, she was wearing glasses. All I could think to do when I first arrived in this foreign country was to buy trivial novelties that accentuated cultural differences. So jet-lagged, I walked to the first corner store I saw to buy ketchup-flavored potato chips. I offered them to Corin, to no avail. I tried to cheer her up with 10 bags of salty junk food in our room, where we rolled out our sleeping bags on the floor. Corin and I had no money. We had traveler's checks and a $600 limit on my father's credit card. All this was to last nearly 3 months. We subsisted mostly on vegetarian pasties and soda and spent way too much energy trying to find the perfect school uniforms at charity shops in hopes that they might make good stage clothes. We had Army-Navy surplus backpacks so large it looked like we were giving free piggyback rides. We camped in the Blue Mountains where a Gila monster invaded the grounds and we fled back to the city. With so much conspiring against us, most of it laughable and ridiculous, Corin warmed up to me again. We were on an adventure. We had known the Canaanes, Stephen, and Fran Gibson through letters, in the odd, endearing way that bands on like-minded labels formed an imitation cousinhood. We were welcomed into their home without much introduction or backstory, merely a shared interest in music, both making and listening, and a tacit acknowledgement that we knew some of the same people. Little vouching for one another was needed. Sight unseen, Stephen and Fran let us stay at their house for nearly a month. They cooked for us, made us tea in the afternoons, took us on ferry rides around the Sydney Harbor and to the aquarium. Corin and I were awed and grateful, though we felt a tad unworthy. We offered to do the dishes, not exactly certain how to compensate for their largesse or blatant display of adulthood, barely out of adolescence ourselves. My and Corin's lack of pre-planning about the entire trip made for moments of giddy spontaneity, but also frequent errors in judgment and manners. One night I stuffed an entire plate of squid pasta into the waist of my pants. A week later I spent 2 days in bed after eating something called nut meat that I was certain had been pronounced nutmeg when I agreed to eat it. We kept forgetting to tell people we were vegetarians. On one occasion, my grandparents, concerned for our well-being on foreign soil, implored us to meet up with the cousins of their friends from back in Tucson. Thus it came to be that one afternoon, Fela and Felix Rosenblum, along with their daughter and granddaughter, hosted Corin and me for a 6-course lunch. Fela served us roast beef with an arm bearing her Holocaust tattoo. Neither Corin nor I had the nerve to refuse her offerings. Our choice of vegetarianism had unclear origins to begin with, but whatever they were, they felt paltry now. Neither Corin nor I have been vegetarian since. There is something freeing in seeing yourself in a new context. People have no preconceived notion of who you are, and there is a relief in knowing that you can recreate yourself. When you're entrenched in a community of people who know you, it's scary to proclaim wanting to be different and wanting to experiment. We went to the other side of the world to make our own sound. Usually this is a methodology you employ as a restart later in your career. We did it right up front. We traveled to a foreign country for our first record. We had to uproot ourselves, not because we were deep into career ruts or didn't want to give credit to the places we had come from, but because we had no desire to sound like or emulate anything that had come before. It was an extreme way to start, but I learned later on how hard it can become to unsettle yourself, to trip yourself up, and I think that's a good place to write from. It's important to undermine yourself and create a level of difficulty so the work doesn't come too easily. The more comfortable you get, the more money you earn, the more successful you are, the harder it is to create situations where you have to prove yourself and make yourself not just want it, but need it. The stakes should always feel high. Stephen drummed for us in his living room as we began working on songs that would become our first record. Many of the earliest tunes didn't even have names. We called them Last Song, Slow Song, as if it were enough to merely have a song, a band. Titles? Who needed them? These were crude, blunt stabs with cookie-cutter structures. We didn't do any editing. The first idea was the only idea. There was no best, worst, or better, just raw attempts. We didn't modify or agonize. The chords and melodies were written. The structure was a container for what was less of a song and more of an attitude. We filled up these shapes with riffs and screams and yelps. I was not self-conscious about the writing process. I wrote rudimentary but melodic leads over Corin's crunchy 3 or 4 chord progressions. She sang whatever melody first came to her. The notion of simple or complex didn't really matter as much as sound. I guess you'd call that punk, but I also think it's just a matter of creating without the watchful eye of an audience or outside expectations in one's head. These weren't amazing songs, but they would form the foundation for our writing process, which was to create a single sonic sound with 2 guitars, 2 conversations. Corin was shy in person, but confident and earnest on stage. I was introverted and overly cerebral, using playing as a means to get out of my head. Together we felt bold enough to be amplified. What we lacked in deliberation, we made up for in tenacity. We played guitar during the day and jumped on stage at night in pubs, opening for the Canaanes. Stephen wore ski goggles behind the drum kit, as if to make himself incognito. We played fast and out of tune. Our sets lasted about 4 songs. I could never hear my voice in the monitor, whereas Corin flooded the system with her singing. Despite my lack of sophistication or maturity, I was headstrong. My sense of possibility and certainty made me focused. I had blinders on. I was a sprinter. There were no long-term goals. I just knew I'd run as hard as I could in any situation. I'd learned that as an adolescent, to keep moving, to not be dragged down. The best word to describe it is scrappy. I still feel that way today. Put me in a situation and I will find my way out of it or through it. I will hustle and scramble. I hate losing. Only later do I think about how it looks from the outside, and then I get stuck in a cycle of shame or anxiety. But in the moment, I rarely could see beyond it. I really could fight. I didn't think much about how it looked from the outside, or how I looked. I strummed, I played, I let the music shake me and awaken me, and then we'd be done. We'd leave the stage. And I'd return to being sheepish and stiff, overly concerned. The music really did feel like a cloak, and slowly I could wear that cloak, that confidence, in other settings, in conversations, at dinner parties or events, in school. At Evergreen, I was too nervous to speak up in class. I knew what I wanted to say, but didn't know how to interject or insert myself in a conversation. By the time I got up the nerve, my voice would be shaking, so even if I was saying something relatively innocuous or factual, I sounded like I was full of passion, emphatic, on the verge of crying. It was humiliating, and my professors often noted my lack of participation. It took a very long time to catch up with my performer self, to draw from that strength. Corin had been in touch with her friend Ian, who was a fanzine writer and musician, and she'd asked him about finding someone to play drums for us in Australia. We knew Stephen was only a temporary solution. Ian put us in touch with Laura McFarlane, who lived in Melbourne and played drums in the Sea Hags. On what was essentially a blind date, we decamped for Melbourne, where we met our drummer. We hadn't actually listened to any recordings on which he played drums. Again, verbal testimony and vouching were enough. Somewhere, we knew, we had a bandmate. Laura had dimples and an infectious, conspiratorial laugh. She was a sprightly elfin Scot who had grown up in Perth and played drums and guitar and sang. Unlike the ruddy surfer Australian stock, her hair was dark and her skin was light. She had a way of darting through a room. Melbourne proved to feel much more akin to the Pacific Northwest than Sydney. Sydney was beautiful, but it felt more sophisticated. Melbourne had a grittiness that was relatable. The music scene was more politicized, more youthful. We stayed at the house of a girl named Sam, who wrote a zine called Grot Girl. Everyone seemed to have their own version of Riot Girl and their interpretation of punk rock feminism. These created a shorthand. It was reassuring to come across what felt like a network of people finding their voices for the first time. Those individual expressions formed a collective force, one that may have been lacking in refinement, but was deeply sincere. That lack of composure made it even more unapologetic. And even if that gumption was compensatory, I think it's what scared people so much. In those years, I was in awe of the bravery I saw around me. I never quite felt brave myself then, but I watched a lot of fearless things happen. I could play at bravery in the songs. I could play at sexiness or humor long before I could actually be or embody any of those things. Slater Kinney allowed me to try on so many roles. I think the music I both played and listened to, along with the unmasked confessional writing in the fanzines, really created a vocabulary for me. Sometimes the works were smart or pithy, profound, poetic. Often they were really messy. But they formed a boundary and a foundation for a lot of girls who had been undone by invisibility, including myself. Girls wrote and sang about sexism and sexual assault, about shitty bosses and boyfriends, about fucking and wanting to fuck. They called out friends and relatives and bands and businesses, corporations and governments for what they felt were injustices. It was a very reactionary time. Each step felt like a landmine. On a personal level, and from those closest to you or in and around your community, you might get zined. The term for devoting pages of a fanzine to a person's perceived racist, sexist, classist, ageist, transphobic, whateverist behavior. I became acutely aware of myself as a political entity, but while the discourse felt important, necessary even, it also felt stifling. The perimeters felt unclear, almost like traps. Those bolder than I set forth unabashedly and were willing to be called out. But I stuck to watching it happen, on the periphery of the dialogue as an audience member and supporter, too scared to commit something treasonous. Only in the early songs was I willing to emulate that sort of naming and blaming, reclamation and wound sharing. I didn't know how to really process those things in person. Slater Kinney was never good at mythologizing. Earnest and unadorned, we were never self-effacing or apologetic. We just never thought to create a narrative other than the one we were living, never thought to heighten the story. The music was the only story. It really felt like a scratch or a scrawl. It didn't have an intentional design, but you could read into it. You could wonder about it. The mystery was in the plainness, the starkness. Sometimes I wish we'd had an elevated sense of mythos, that we'd come up in another scene, like 1970s New York with Richard Hell in television, the New York Dolls in Blondie, or David Bowie in glam rock in England, or the Mods, or even just picking a dress code or a way of amplifying the sense of time and place. I remember trying to think of a different last name for myself, Rachel? Kinney? Always we just ended up back at who we were. It was so Northwest, all about the music. The 90s had a monolithic feel, a sturdiness, realism as opposed to fantasy. In the punk scenes we came from, honesty was valued tantamount, or even more so than artistry. Even influencers and icons like Calvin Johnson or Kathleen Hanna, both much more aware of persona than anyone in my band, were still brought back down to earth by their engagement with politics and ethics. Once you have to explain or over-explain what you're doing, it's hard to be larger than life. Every time you have to talk about it, you feel smaller. More accessible, perhaps, but certainly not mythic. At shows, we often felt too brash, too bawdy. Korn's bravado was apt to court controversy, like the time in her hometown of Eugene, Oregon, when she yelled at a sound guy on my behalf that I couldn't hear my vocals, and he got so fed up that he shut off the PA. We played anyway, and despite the futility and comedic potential, we even sang into the mics, miming our outrage to the audience. I wore business casual clothes on stage, dressed up as if for a job, as if I were mocking professionalism, but also trying to emulate it. It was my version of putting on nice clothes because guests were coming over. I remained guileless for a long while in terms of stage clothes. What I was actually trying to do was pull off a mod look from the 60s or 70s, The Jam, The Small Faces, The Who, early Stones. But instead of buying the clothes at cool London vintage stores, I was purchasing them, or stealing them sometimes, from a shopping mall in Olympia. They were always loose-fitting, saggy-assed, made for an inelegant tomboy. Mostly, I didn't want to be a girl with a guitar. Girl felt like an identifier that viewers, especially male ones, saw as a territory upon which an electric guitar was a tourist, an interloper. I wanted the guitar to be an appendage, an extension even, of a body that was made more powerful by my yielding of it. My look, Mick Jagger in sweatpants, wasn't trying to make a statement. The premise we all worked from was to be yourself, even if half the time I only knew who I was on stage. It makes for an interesting performance, attempting to both find yourself and lose yourself on stage. That's a lot of pressure on a band, to encompass both menace and protector. But our audience seemed to feel that and need it too. They found themselves in our songs, saw themselves, felt safe enough to let go only because we'd given them solid ground from which to step off. I'm not being self-aggrandizing. It meant the same to me. The night before we left Australia, we recorded the 10 songs we had written. Laura's roommate, Nick Carroll, ran cables from the mixing board in his bedroom on the second floor, through the hallway, down the stairs, and into the rat-infested, sawdust-covered garage where Korn and I had been both sleeping and rehearsing. With less than 14 hours until we left the country, we played through the songs live and then tracked our vocals. We did one take, two at the most if we made a mistake we couldn't live with. No overdubs, no redos. Giddy from hearing ourselves on tape and bleary with exhaustion, we sat on the couch while Nick mixed the record until dawn. Then he drove us to the airport and we flew home to America. Back in Olympia, we remixed the record with Tim Green at the Red House and put it out on Chainsaw Records. It would be self-titled, simple. It was more of a document than an album, a timestamp. We had not quite built the band yet. That would come with our second album. But we had opened the box and pulled out the parts we needed in order to assemble Sleater-Kinney. Chapter 8. Call the Doctor. Donna Dresch ran Chainsaw Records and was sort of a legend in the Olympia scene. A great guitar player, a shredder with long blonde hair and a cool, timeless vibe. She had played with Screaming Trees, the Canadian punk's Fifth Column, and Dinosaur Jr., which automatically made her someone you felt was blessing you with her presence. Donna had been to the outer edges of our scene and beyond, but she wasn't a snob. She had a sweet diffidence. She had turned Chainsaw from a zine into a label as a way of putting out her own band, the incendiary Team Dresch, along with other bands she knew and loved. Donna was an out lesbian, had been for as long as anyone could remember, and her band got lumped in with an offshoot of punk and indie called Queercore. Those identifiers felt important at the time. People were staking out territory, constructing niches in a punk landscape that felt vast. Parceled out like land claims, punk was divided by city, by sound, and by indexers like gender and sexual orientation. But really, Team Dresch was a rock band, and a superb one. They stood out for their chops and their fondness for solos and big choruses, all the conventional things that a lot of the punk bands weren't really doing, at least not in Olympia. Team Dresch tore up the stage, allowing their listeners, who included a lot of young queer kids, to act out their audience fantasies in a way they maybe hadn't been allowed to do, or felt safe enough to do, at other shows. As much as the person on stage is performing, so too is the audience. Many of us looked up to Team Dresch, Corin and I included. They were a few years older. They had a lot of experience touring, recording, and putting out records. There was a real intention behind what they were doing, and the music came first. Plus, they were funny. One day they showed up at my and Corin's apartment with a bag of sex toys they'd purchased in Seattle and demoed them in our living room, much to our embarrassment and amusement. They didn't take themselves too seriously, even though the stakes were high and their songs were heartfelt. We saw a lot of elements cohere in Team Dresch that we admired. They were bold, yet accessible. You could listen to their songs as a guide to surviving, or you could just rock out. Our drummer Laura flew over from Australia in the summer of 1995, and we set up shows along the West Coast. Our first show was on Northeast Alberta Street in Portland, now known as the Alberta Arts District, littered with coffee shops, fancy dog boutiques, tea emporiums, and shops selling ice cream, apparently worth waiting in line for. At the time, it was mostly a Latino and African American neighborhood with a handful of long-established businesses. Early in the stages of what is a typical gentrification pattern, white and or punk queers and artists had started moving there for the cheap rent. We played a newly opened lesbian-owned cafe called Shea What. In the audience were Donna, Kathleen Hanna, Miranda July, our friends and people we looked up to. We played the songs off our first record with the aid, or perhaps hindrance, of a crappy, inadequate vocal PA. No sound check. Corin yowled over the drums and the amps we borrowed from the headliner, but my voice couldn't rise above the cacophony. I had no sense of who or what we were as a band. We didn't feel important, more that we had announced our arrival, that we were knocking on the door. Still, I had to concentrate to play and to feel comfortable. People bobbed their heads along to the music. We felt supported, nurtured, but unremarkable. Next, we played a club called Moe's in Seattle to about 4 people, which is such a small crowd that it's hard to tell if you even need to play at all. It's also one more person in the audience than is on stage. The formality, the mystery, any heightened sense of performance is sucked out of the room. But we ran through our songs anyway, smiling awkwardly in between, an awareness forming of the disparity between the sound of our music and what felt like our small, unassuming selves. We borrowed Corin's father's VW bus for the tour through California, shoving drums and guitars and cables into drawers and cabinets otherwise designed for dishware and camping gear. There was no air conditioning. We misted ourselves with spray bottles of water, and we often had to stop on account of the engine overheating. That summer, there was a series of Riot Girl festivals and conventions, which were mostly single shows featuring more than 4 bands and maybe a few people selling fanzines. One of the best aspects of Riot Girl was that anyone could adopt the term as their own. It wasn't prescriptive. However, this ambiguity left room for a lot of interpretation. It was on this tour that I witnessed a girl with a tampon as a hair accessory, and another with the word hippo written across her t-shirt with a Sharpie. Reclamation had no bounds. Chainsaw had put out a compilation record and booklet called Free to Fight, marrying punk and self-defense. We played some of these shows as well. Team Dresch were at the center of Free to Fight, but they brought along instructors too, creating a combination of musical theater, martial arts, university lecture, and rock show. No mixing of elements felt too conspicuous or incongruous. It was akin to a circus sideshow that was finally getting center stage, even if we were building that stage on our own, a few hours before the show began. We asked Donna if she would put out our next record. Laura was heading back to Australia, so we needed to set up something quickly before she left. We managed to book a session with John Goodmanson, whom we had each worked with in Heavens to Betsy and Excuse 17, and who had recorded the Bikini Kill and Team Dresch albums. There was a sense of inevitability to everything back then. It was all funneled through the same people, recording or label-wise, an organism we all fed into. We recorded Call the Doctor in 5 days. John and Stu's recording was housed in a narrow wedge-shaped building on the edge of the Fremont neighborhood in Seattle. Nirvana had recorded Bleach there when it was Jack and Dino's place, Reciprocal. The small live room had high ceilings, carpet, dartboards, and novelty record sleeves on the wall, and an old record player. The control room was tiny. There was no lounge area. You were either in the studio or you were outside, a claustrophobic and immersive experience. We set up our amps and drums in the main room with no separation save for baffling. We didn't think to adjust sounds or levels between songs or to switch out guitars for a different tone. We just played the songs through until we felt like we'd gotten a good take. We didn't know any other way of recording. We had never worked with a producer before, and John was still coming into his own as one. He was a fantastic engineer, fastidious and fast, capable of harnessing energy and getting good sounds on the fly. He was like a documentarian at the time, present more to observe, capture, and facilitate than to change what we had or who we were. There was really nothing to contemplate anyhow. The recording was perfunctory. The songs were the songs. The sound was the sound. There was nothing to unearth or reveal through the magic of recording. We put some of our vocals through an amp to make them distorted. We doubled guitars on the choruses. John panned Korn's guitar to one side and mine to the other. If you listen to the album through a busted speaker or headphone, you can only hear half the song. The whole thing felt as urgent as the title. What more was there to do? Despite the no-frills approach to recording, the songwriting on Call the Doctor brought in characteristics that came to define our sound. On the title track, Corin and I each sang a melody on the chorus. She was louder than me, so her vocal was the lead by default, but we never really considered one a background part to the other. It was a conversation we were having. She had her perspective and I had mine. Or I was emphasizing her point, retelling it even as I was singing along with her. And our guitars did the same thing, augmenting and counteracting each other. We would get to the chorus, and intuitively you'd think this is the time for us to all sing together, and there should be a cohesion, but instead we would split apart. It was almost an anti-chorus. We weren't trying to form a solidarity with anyone but ourselves. Could you sing along the Slater Kinney? Sometimes, but we just as likely shout over you, and good luck trying to sing along with Corin. Trust me, I know. It's nearly impossible. As a listener, you have to decide what to follow in the song, which vocal, which guitar. This way of writing and of singing was something we tacitly understood. We never discussed it. We never mentioned counter melodies. We didn't want to sing harmonies. Our songs weren't pretty, nor was our style of singing. It sounded scarier to not sing together, rarely allowing the listener to settle into the music. Everything inside the songs was constantly on the verge of breaking apart. Corin's voice, the narrative, the guitars, so few moments provided any respite at all. If we did sing together on the chorus, it was only after a strange, uncomfortable verse. Yet the result was forceful. It sounded like a tightly bound entity, fragments clinging to each other for dear life. If you pulled one thing apart, it wouldn't even sound like a real song. It was a junkyard come to life. Corin was working at Kit's Camera in the Olympia Mall, and many of the songs on Call the Doctor address feeling objectified, being watched, as if you're living your life for yourself, but with the awareness that it's not just for you. There are other people taking notice, observing. It's a disorienting duality and a tiring scrutiny. So much of working customer service is about self-erasure, subjugating and then selling yourself in order to sell the product, merging with the commodities until you feel like one. Like many young women, we felt like we were on display. Lyrically, the songs read like someone setting off an alarm, trying to transform victimization into power. These are not subtle songs. They want to socialize you. They want to purify you. They want to dignify and analyze and terrorize you, Corin sings on the title song, followed by, "All Your Life is Written for You." Then, on I'm Not Waiting, Corin takes on the role of a voyeur. "Go out on the lawn. Put your swimsuit on," she snarls, before she reverts to the role of a young girl and sings, "I'm not waiting till I grow up to be a woman." It's an audacious cry, desperately trying for womanhood to be an act of self-possession as opposed to an invitation. But the idea of not waiting until one grows up implies that there is hardly any age that is too young for a woman to be sexualized. Your words are sticky, stupid, running down my leg. The song has a foreboding creepiness, as if the male gaze and the language that augments it carry an implicit objectification. The power and hurt of words and images are indistinct from the tactile. For I Want to Be Your Joey Ramone, I had driven over to the practice space by myself and written the verses, the guitar part, and the vocal melody. As I often did, I left the chorus open for Corin to sing. Joey was really the first song that set a precedent for what would become our habit of meta-songwriting, where we were in a band writing about being in a band, singing about singing. I feel the need to point out that our intent was different from those classic rock songs about being on tour. This isn't a singing about roadies, drugs, and groupies, about watching movies on the bus, about rambling on and taking care of business. We were in dialogue with ourselves. We responded to and addressed the fans, the critics, and even our own work. Later songs, such as Male Model or Number One Must Have, explain the earlier ones. I Want to Be Your Joey Ramone, Little Babies, discussing what we had already done and why we had done it. There was a sense of substantiation, of clarification. Joey Ramone was a performer who embodied both gawkiness and grandiosity. He was simultaneously awkward, with his spindly legs and his hair falling into his face, and larger than life. This contradiction seemed to be an ideal metaphor for my own relationship to performing and music. Part of me wanted to own the stage, while the other part of me remained uncomfortable with such power. I suppose some people are born with the certainty that they own sound or volume, that the lexicon of rock music is theirs to borrow from, to employ, to interpret. For them, it might be nothing to move around on stage, to swagger, to sing in front of people, to pick up a guitar, to make records. I set out from a place where I never assumed that those were acceptable choices or that I could be anything but an accessory to rock and roll. The archetypes, the stage moves, the representations of rebellion and debauchery were all male. When Sleater-Kinney first began, it seemed to me that the only way to get a sense of rock and roll was to experience it vicariously. The song was about stepping into someone else's shoes as a means of exploring both my fears and aspirations. I wanted a glimpse of the absurdity, the privilege, and the decadence that hadn't been inherently afforded to us. I Want to Be Your Joey Ramone was a test for ourselves, to see what it felt like to give yourself the smallest amount of power, and to put that power on display, to be unafraid and unafraid of yourself. So in Sleater-Kinney, we sang a lot about a world that we wished we could access without the added explanation or justification. We sang about playing and performing, as if in singing about it, we could really live it, free of judgment or the feeling that we were interlopers. We would project ourselves into a song where we couldn't be impeached. We were stating our validity for the record over and over again, staking our claim, then having to explain it, then drawing yet another line in the sand. In our songs about music, we created our own new malleable versions of us, ones that our earnest, overly explanatory selves could pretend to inhabit. Because we felt like outsiders, both in Olympia and Portland, to some extent, but also at festivals and in the mainstream world, we often wrote about rock music. We wrote and played ourselves right into existence. Even with subsequent records, Joy was always a reminder not to take what we had for granted, not to create from a place of smugness or entitlement. We were confident for sure, but we were aware of how uncertainty fomented a sense of having to prove oneself, how it fostered an urgency. This is where we were starting to grapple with something we would grapple with for the rest of our time as a band, that there was always a sense we were going to have to defend and analyze what we were doing. Why are you in an all-female band? Why do you not have a bass player? What does it feel like to be a woman in a band? I realized that those questions, that talking about the experience, had become part of the experience itself. More than anything, I feel that this meta-discourse, talking about the talk, is part of how it feels to be a woman in music, or a woman in anything for that matter, politics, business, comedy, power. There is the music itself, and then there is the ongoing dialogue about how it feels. The two seem to be intertwined and also inescapable. To this day, because I know no other way of being or feeling, I don't know what it's like to be a woman in a band. I have nothing else to compare it to. But I will say that I doubt in the history of rock journalism and writing, any man has been asked, Why are you in an all-male band? On the last day of mixing, called the doctor. Korn and I lay on the floor and listened while John played the album back in its entirety. I remember thinking that we had made a decent record, that I hadn't heard anything that sounded like this before. I don't think I ever really felt that way again about one of our records, simply able to enjoy it without